No niin, sinne meni taas yksi aasi.
Rakkauden vappuradio. Huonoja aasinsiltoja jo vuodesta 2010.
Tupsulan pikkujouluissa oli niin paljon punaista valoa, että kaikki näkyi vihreänä monta päivää.
Käytiin Talent Hervannassa keikalla ja korvat soi 3 viikkoa sen
jälkeen. Savua oli kaikkialla. Paloautojen pillit huusivat ja lapset itkivät. Se oli kamalaa.
Riemurinne. Ääntä, valoa, savua ja tuskaa.
Mihinköhän tämäkin polku johtaa? Mutta tuolla onpa hienoja uramahdollisuuksia. Valitse polku, joka johtaa harkkapaikkaan rakennusalan ykkösyrityksessä. Ota seurantaan @raksaduuni Instagramissa ja tutustu yit.fi/polku.
Hei, miksi tuolla joulupukilla on teekkarilakki?
Ho, ho, ho. Minä olen myyjä. Mitä sinä olet toivonut vappulahjaksi?
Valmista tutkin.
Minulla on sinulle tamppi.
Vappulehtitamppi. Varmempi kuin valkoinen joulu. Myynnissä nyt.
Oi pyhä vappu sen tärpämä! Me olemme pulassa! Tarroja, Robbe! Me tarvitsemme äkkiä tarroja! Mutta mistä me saamme tähän hätään tarroja, Bämä? Vappuradion kopeilta tietysti, Robbe! Sieltä saa myös kangaskasseja, haalarimerkkejä, teepaitoja ja kohta myös sukkia!
Oi pyhä radiokoppi sentään! Onko siellä myös kylmälaukku?
Ei ole! Mene jo!
Hyttynen tässä, terve. Mäkin kuuntelen Radiokopissa rakkauden vappuradiota raikuvien aplodien saattelemana.
Uskomaton tohtorissykerö on. Sateenvarjon avulla hyppien pikkumies tuo eläinten hauskojen luo. Uskomaton tohtori sykerö on. Keksi koneen, jolla voi matkustaa tähtiin. Sateenkaaren taakse luo ystävien. Kiipeliin jäähän, voittamaton tohtori sykerö on.
Welcome to Rakkauden Vappuradio. Now we are starting with a new show called Science Now. And I'm Janne, sometimes online also known as Bjantse. And, well, I'll first introduce a little bit of myself. So I have done my Doctor of Science in Technology degree here in Tampere University. And I'm researching biomaterials for biomedical applications, focusing on hydrogels. And then we have another interviewer here in our studio.
Hello, everyone. I'm Caro, or sometimes called Argent, and I'm doing PhD and working with hydrogels as well.
And then we have our each of our 4 shows we have a different guest, and so today could you introduce yourself?
Hello, everyone. My name is Ismael. So I'm a postdoc research fellow in social science, looking at water politics in West and Central Africa. Yeah. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Yeah. So actually, Ismael and I, we both have this same Tampere Institute for Advanced Studies postdoctoral fellowship. I just started mine 1 year before him. So that's how I found out that he is doing interesting science. So, well, maybe could you a little bit briefly explain more? To another song and then go deeper after that.
Yeah, sure. So my project looks at basically how people access water in countries where there's no widely accessible network which supplies water. And it looks at drinking water at the intersection with other forms of issues, for example, flooding, so what we call the water landscape more broadly. And it's a project which is based on empirical research looking at people in the field and how they actually access water in the field and how they... how they struggle to access water in the field. So I'm looking at two countries in West and Central Africa, Chad and Cameroon. And basically it involves going there to do some data collection once in a while. And it's based on interviews with people who struggle to access water. It's based also on observations in areas affected by issues related to access to water and to natural disasters like flooding, droughts, and so on. So yeah, it's a little bit what I'm doing.
Yeah. Let's put a song and then get deeper into this.
Katson pilvi. Mut aurinko paistaa silmiin, se päähän tekee kipeä, mun ote elämästä lipeä. Jos mulla ei ois sua, mulla ei ois mitään.
Suussa ja mulla ois minien paikka kuninkaiden suussa. Godzilla tässä terve. Aivan kuten Rakkauden vappuradion tekijät, mäkin olen radioaktiivinen.
So, science now, not talking about radioactivity this time, but about water politics. So, Ismail, first of all, how did you end up in Finland?
Well, it was a little bit an accident, really, but a good one, a good accident, because academia can be sometimes a very precarious field, so you have to apply to many jobs, and sometimes not only in one country. Mm-hmm. I just applied for a number of postdocs following my PhD, which I did in the UK. At the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, and I ended up being welcomed here, and I'm actually very happy. So to be affiliated with this Institute for Advanced Study, where we are working. Focus on my research for 2 years. There's not so many jobs which allow to do this, so... That's a little bit how I ended up here. Before that, I was living in France, in Lyon, for a few months, doing a first postdoc following my mm-hmm. PhD. It was just 9 months, and as I was saying beforehand, I was studying for my PhD, which also dealt with water politics. It was a bit more narrow in terms of geographical focus. It was looking at one city and the drinking water access and supply in one city, which is in N'Djamena, the capital of Chad. And nowadays, I expanded on this for this project here in Finland.
Sorry, can you repeat, how do I pronounce correctly the capital of Chad?
N'Djamena.
N'Djamena.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I read your article and I was thinking that I don't know how to pronounce this.
Yeah. Well, it's not a very well-known city, I guess, in many parts of the world. But
yeah. Sure. So then... how did you end up with this kind of this focus in your research? So why, I don't know, why water politics? Why Chad?
Sure. I mean, it's a legitimate question because people ask me that often because I don't have a family connection myself there. That had never been there and I couldn't actually place the country on a map. So it just turned out that back in the days when I was studying for my master's, I had some funding to do field research in an African country. There was a master focusing on African anthropology, history and politics. Mm-hmm. And it turned out I had friends in Chad. And the country really captured my attention because it's right in the middle of the African continent. So it's at the crossroad of North Africa, Central Africa, Western, Eastern Africa. So, and I noticed this, and I also noticed that there was very limited research conducted there. So I said, why not going there? My friend said, oh, well, we can host you for months, no problem. You can come and just do your research. And it turned out it was like I fell in love with the country and the interactions I had there with the people. And I wrote a master dissertation. And then the year after that, I started my PhD focusing on this country. So, yes.
Yeah, actually, one of the articles from you that I was reading, it's like there's a lot of introduction on what kind of country is Chad.
Yeah.
And this was just, it was interesting to read from just this point of view that since I don't know much about the country, okay, I could just open a Wikipedia article, but then it feels more... trustworthy to check, read from your article than from a Wikipedia article?
Yeah, and I think it felt more personal in a sense that it sounded like you had the real experience. Also, in the latest article, I think you had some snippets that sounded like you had actually been there and talking to people, and that made it really interesting to read, even though the field made it also a bit difficult to understand completely, but it was still really enjoyable to read.
Well, thanks very much for these kind words, but honestly, I have to remain humble and I won't pretend I know everything about water politics in Chad or in Western and Central Africa. I just did one project and I collected some data and I'm trying to make something out of it. It's also one of the, I would say, maybe one of the predicaments or the problems with social sciences and especially ethnographic research. Maybe I can say a word about what is ethnography. Yes. basically, it's very broadly, it's there's this famous American anthropologist, Clifford Geertz, who was probably the most famous cultural anthropologist back in the 80s, who defined ethnography as thick description of culture. So you have a culture and you're trying to define capture what this culture is about through thick description. So it can sound very broad, but it involves spending a lot of time within a particular culture, describing it, trying to speak the language, trying to identify some patterns in this culture. So there's been ethnographic research about Finland, of course, and trying to analyze what this culture is about. So I tried to do that. Of course, I have to acknowledge also the limitations of my work. It's important when you do social sciences that I couldn't describe all of it. But I tried to use some of the materials I gathered, the interviews, the observations I did, in order to make an argument about this. And maybe I can say a word about the research methods, because I guess if people studying chemistry, physics, or so on are listening to us, maybe it sounds a bit abstract, all of this. Basically, studying water involved, in my case, going to water spots across the city. So usually in public places, because a lot of the people don't have home water access. Mm-hmm. So they would just access water in fountains, public fountains, private fountains, just stand pipes which are in the streets or in squares. So just going there, trying to talk to people over there, or just sometimes just sitting on a bench and observing, taking notes, drawing. You have lots of people actually drawing things when they do ethnographic research. And after that, trying also to interact with the people and get some appointments for interviews. Okay, so you are a neighbor using this water place every day. How do you use it? And also, what is your background? How did you end up living there? And what's your relationship with water and so on? So sometimes it would go into different directions and it could sound a bit also messy in the sense that you don't exactly know what you're going to find out, and it's you don't necessarily have very clear hypothesis about what you're going to find out. That's also the beauty of it, I think.
So I think this sounds much more like this like old school not really research, but like adventuring or like I'm missing a word here.
Maybe exploring?
Yeah. Yeah, like this kind of explorers from the 1600th century or something who were like, you know, taking a boat to a different continent, and then of course there were a lot of people just conquering the land, but then there were also these kind of scholars at least every now and then who were really writing down how does the local culture look like and this kind of exploration.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's adventures. I'm a bit suspicious towards excessive romanticizing anthropological research or ethnographic research in social sciences, because it can sound a bit romantic to go in a place which is remote and trying to find out what people are doing. No, I would just say there's this word in social sciences and in philosophy called serendipity. So serendipity, it's about coming over and not necessarily knowing what you're going to find out, and you find out. So it's maybe a bit more humble than actually saying adventures. Or also, it involved my research involved also sometimes booking interviews with people in an office doing something. So I interviewed also policymakers, municipal officers, or people working for NGOs in office, because their own NGOs or their own organizations was involved in water and sanitation issues. So this was not only in the public space, just looking around, hope what's going to happen, and so on. And also a lot of it, it's very important to stress that a lot of it is about waiting. So sometimes you might sit somewhere just observing the social interactions around you, and not much seems to happen. So you're just like, okay. But very often, this not much is also interesting, because it tells you something about the temporalities or something about the place where you are currently. So yeah, it's this is also very important to remember that.
I think when I'm thinking about like administrative sciences, what comes to my mind is really the politics, as in maybe interviewing the policymakers, lawmakers, and like studying what the laws are, instead of studying how the people behave. But that's maybe me not being in the field.
Yeah, I think politics is a tricky term. It can have a lot of meanings. You have, of course, the party politics, the broader politics, or the politics of policymakers, the ones who are implementing political decisions. So this is one level, but there are other levels. There's also the micropolitics, what's happening here in Hervanta at the level of the neighborhood, the interactions between neighbors. So in one street, you could do actually an ethnography here of Hervanta if you wanted, go into one street and see what are the issues existing at the level of the street, or what are the tensions which might oppose neighbors, that kind of things.
I think there could be tons of ethnographic research done on how the students spent this Vappu time, and how the different study disciplines spent Vappu differently, and interactions and disagreements and all kinds of things. So I think certainly there, based on your description, there could be a lot of ethnographic research on Vappu as well.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like you could have different subsections of students, or just comparing how students as one bigger group behave during the Vappu. But should we take a next song?
Yep, let's go for one more song now, and then,
Yes.
Thank you.
Hei, ootko koettanut tsempata?
Oh, heti parempi olo.
Rakkauden vappuradio.
Tässä on tää meidän ruokatilaus.
Oota, käy nopee säästöpossulla.
Mikä säästöpossu? Sullahan on tuolla koko säästösikala.
Tähän pahan päivän varalle säästin.
Liittyisit sinäkin tekijäseneksi ja koko kassaan.
Koko kassa. Työttömyysturvaa koko rahalla.
Juman kautta niin justiin olin tuossa lyömään askonaa parkkiin Laukontorille ja siitä sitten parkkilippua hakeen automaatille, niin siinä on joku ihme kekkeruusi työntään pullonkorkkeja sinne masinaan ja hyvän 15 minuuttia siinä odottelen, niin pääsen...
Tule pois sieltä 90-luvulta ja maksa pysäköinti ja lataus e-parking-sovelluksella.
Mä en taas huvita yhtään mikään.
e-parking.fi
Welcome to the Hydraulic Press Radio. Today we are crushing mobile phone. As you can see, it is completely crushed. And now we must go to Fonum to fix it.
Fonum. Korjaa puhelimesi nopeammin kuin se ehtii hajota.
Täällä sademetsässä löytyy vaikka minkälaista elämää. Esimerkiksi alkukantainen Homo sapiens, jolla näyttäisi olevan läppäri kädessä. Läppäri!
Joo, on M-Filesilla töissä. Voi tehdä töitä missä vaan.
Nämä ihmiset tekee tätä joka päivä.
Rakkauden vappuradio.
Rakkauden vappuradio, Science Now. Today we have Ismail with us talking about social sciences or administrative sciences and water politics.
Yeah, so I have mentioned already that I have read the latest article of your work, and I was wondering how did you end up with water porters as your case study, and I think it would be also good if you could briefly explain what are water porters for our listeners who may not have read your paper.
First of all, thank you very much for reading my article. I think you must be one of the two or three people in the world who actually read this. So I ended up going to, as I was saying, places in the public space where people access water, because that's how, not only in Central Africa, but in many parts of the world, that's how people access water on a daily basis, because they don't have a home water supply connection. So I ended up there working with a research collaborator who took me to a market. And over there we found out, and well, people didn't find out, they knew, because they would experience that on a daily basis. But a lot of workers, individuals who were carrying, who were pushing carts full of water cans everywhere in the city. And we realized that it would be very interesting to look at how it is done on a daily basis, the interactions and the business around it, the economy around pushing carts full of water cans all around. And we realized that there was a whole culture, a whole work culture, labor culture around this economy of water porting around. So with my colleague, we interviewed many of these workers. Some they had all kinds of trajectories. Some of them were coming from the countryside. Others had been living most of their lives in the capital city. And there was also a lot of course, conflicts. And it's a difficult job. It's a very physical job, demanding job. And there was a lot of conflicts to analyze. And there was also a lot of solidarity between the different water workers. So, okay, and it's something which can be observed in various lines of business under very, very difficult circumstances. People help each other. People find ways to help each other. to survive, basically. So that's how I ended up writing about labor culture, of the labor culture of water workers. So it includes the porters who push the carts, but it also includes fontaine managers. It includes the owners of the water spots. Sometimes they can be private and they can be public. And I thought it was relevant to analyze this because, as I said, it's not only the case in one country, but in most countries in the world, that's the kind of methods people use in order to access water. And everyone is a water end user. I've never met anyone who doesn't use water, who doesn't drink water. So it's pretty general. It's a very, very general relational substance which create connections between human beings often. And it's also a source of conflicts, but it creates also a lot of solidarity.
So now one thing that came to my mind, this maybe classic, I don't know, is it from the UK originally, but this kind of milkman, which no longer is really a profession in Europe, but maybe 50 years ago or 100 years ago, it was a common that there was a milkman who morning. So these water porters have very similar role, kind of. So if they are, at least in the introduction in your articles, like guy bringing a can of water or cans of water every morning to a family. So,
yeah, I mean, the thing with water is that you also need to stock it and to keep some at home to drink, of course, but also to do cleaning, to do all kinds of things. So if you don't have a pipe supply, if you don't get access to piped water at home, then you need to find other ways. So, and sometimes also you're away at work and you need someone to deliver water at home. So when you come back home, you have some stocks of water at your home. So very often we would follow, we shadowed.
Yeah.
We followed water porters around doing their deliveries, reaching their customer's house. Sometimes there was just like the children or just a woman at home opening the door for them and paying them and getting the water delivery. So yeah, maybe milk was something in the UK also, which was very part of the culture. They need to stock some water at your home and to make sure this water is clean and that you can use anytime to drink and to do your daily stuff.
In the introduction, I believe it was that you had the story of family having this one porter, and they just told beforehand if they needed more water. So is it always this informal, like you just give the porter a heads up that we will be having some kind of thing?
Yeah, it seemed like it's very flat hierarchy kind of, or not, well, maybe not, that's not the correct way to say it, but it's very like hands on to just like, you have a porter who is bringing you water, and then okay, now we are doing spring cleaning and we need extra water, so tomorrow please bring more.
So I described various configurations. So we didn't have really one case, one way to communicate between the customers and the water sellers. There were many, many ways. So some people actually exchange phone numbers. Mm. In the case, they exchange phone numbers, so they would just ring the water porter, say, okay, I need some water now. Can you just come over? Some others, they didn't know. They had like a very kind of deep connection with the water porter who used to come every day at the same time, and that's it, and they don't need to have any ways to to communicate because it's just very routine thing, really. And other cases, people would just you know, see a man, a water porter in the street and just wave at him, hey, come, we need you to deliver water. So you had very different ways. There's a lot of ways to buy water from the street sellers.
But not so much like a subscription-based, or was it a subscription-based model, or was it more like you pay each batch once you get it?
Yeah, again, you have different cases. So some customers, they would just pay immediately. Others would actually say, okay, I'll pay you at the end of the month because you just come back several times a week or every day. And then at the end of the month or at the end of the week, I'm paying you. Although many very often workers, they didn't like it because sometimes bills are not settled on time and that kind of things. So yeah, it's very hard to find out one way. And I heard a lot of very contradictory stories about what was the most efficient way to buy water in the street. So
yeah, okay. So they didn't. Not everybody agreed on how to do it the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, should we take next song and then continue with this a bit more?
Sure.
Sitä syvyyksissäkin kuunnellaan.
So that came from somewhere very deep. And then what, or could you explain a bit more what you're doing now? What is your current, what are you currently working on?
So the project I was recruited to conduct here at the University of Tampere focuses on something a bit different. So I look not only at one city, as I did for my doctoral study, but I look at like several locations, several communities, and not only in Chad, but also in Cameroon. And I was, as I was saying in the introduction, here it's not only about drinking water, but it's also what we call the waterscape. So what geographers call the waterscape. So it's the water landscape, everything concerning water. So also bodies of water like river, ponds, lakes, and so on. Mm-hmm. And how they can actually be also a source of disasters. And so I was very interested when drafting this project at looking at both excess and scarcity, so these two notions, so the lack of water, but also the excess of water. And the excess of water, it can materialize in things like natural disasters, like flooding and people losing their houses, rivers because of excessive rains and so on. So both. So this is what I found fascinating about water, that it's actually something, required for life, to sustain life, but it's also something that can be very dangerous when there's terrible flooding. The rainy season usually occur in the what we call here the summer, so that's between May and October. So this is the rainy season, where mm-hmm. all the rest of the year is the dry season, so there's almost no rain at all. But during the rainy season, back in the years in 2022, for example, it was a devastating year. It destroyed many communities. It affected also farmers, it affected urbanites and so on. So yeah, this is what I'm looking at currently here at the University of Tampere.
So do you then, is it also like interviewing people and seeing how they have experienced it, or how they have prepared for a disaster, for example? So it's still the ethnographic research, that's the kind of method.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was there for about a month, last month, in February, March, both in Chad and Cameroon. And I went to neighborhoods with colleagues again, because it's also very important to say I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. Often I'm working with colleagues in Chad and Cameroon. I've met very, very competent and skilled Chadian and Cameroonian researchers who very often out over there. So we visited communities which were affected back in the years by in 2022 and also a bit in 2023. But 2022 was a terrible year in terms mm-hmm. of flooding. To see how they managed, how they experienced the disaster, the destruction of their communities because of the flooding, but also how they managed to adapt, the kind of support they received from the government, from international NGOs, from the United Nations agency systems. So all of this, and also see how it is related also to drinking water. How do they manage to access drinking water? Because it's important to say that very often when there's a flood, it contaminates the water supply. So for example, if you're accessing water through a borehole, like, or a well in your garden, the water coming from the river is going to contaminate this water, and you won't be able to drink it. And a lot of people we met actually are not able anymore to drink safe water. And there's a lot of waterborne diseases, things like amebiosis, cholera, and so on, which spread during this time. So that's what I did over the past months. over the months I spent over there, and I hope to go back next year, even though I feel a bit frustrated to be able to go only 1 month. But yeah, it's a lot of logistics, and also here now I have commitments here in Tampere, so I'm trying to balance and do everything.
Yeah, it was actually because when I started to plan this radio show in the beginning of this year, and then I noticed that in February you were not in the colloquium. Mm-hmm. So then I had been thinking that you could be a person I could ask for this, but then it's like, okay, he is not in Finland, so how long are you actually going to be in Chad? So am I going to be able to ask you to join us if you are not present in Finland? But luckily for us, you came back before this radio.
Well, I'm sure you, or if I weren't around, you could have found, we have very talented colleagues who could have come as well. But yes. Yeah, it's a good, I'm happy to be here, and it's a good thing I have this fresh from the field take I can share with you.
Yeah. So then, when can we expect the next article to come out? Maybe this is always a difficult question for a researcher, but how far are you with the current one?
So I have a draft which I shared with the seminar, the anthropology seminar I'm participating in, so at the University of Tampere, the central campus, and we will discuss it this Thursday. Mm-hmm. And but it's a draft, so it can take years before actually it transforms into an article. I think it's also an issue we have, social scientists often, or well, it depends on the field, of course, but often, you know, a natural scientist find out that we are not productive enough because so often we write alone or just up to 2-3 people, and articles can take a lot of time to come out. I know people who it took them 2 years to publish one paper before the moment they actually submitted the initial version and the actual final publication. So it's a very, very long process. But yeah, hopefully in less than 2 years, I'll get the next one.
Well, I have experienced also some articles taking really long time to get published. So it happens also in the engineering fields. It's just that now I lost my thought on that. But what I wanted to briefly mention, there's a couple of movies that come to my mind when talking about water scarcity. So first of all, the very current Dune, which I don't know, have you seen the Dune movies or read the books?
I used to play the video games.
Well, that's a very good good. There's also a very good board game on Dune. Yeah, but there's water is very much one of the key elements, and they are talking about water politics kind of actually even in the Dune movie. So I don't know, maybe it might be interesting. Or I don't know, maybe it's not interesting because it goes too close to your science to kind of compare the fiction, fact and fiction. But yeah.
No, but it's a good point. I wanted to watch the film, just that I've been told that we need to watch it on a big screen to have the full experience. And I missed it when it was being screened at the movie theater. But it's a good point to remember that water also, it fills fiction and imaginaries. It's a substance which is everywhere and nowhere at the same time, because there's a lot of beliefs around, sometimes religious belief around water, and a lot of discussions around the representation in art of water. So it's something very very present in artistic depictions and in, of course, works of fictions like Dune or other science fiction movies. So, and there's also the power aspects, also the control for water, which is like a very old theme in narratives, in stories, and so yeah, I think it's something very very productive in terms of imaginaries and representations.
Yeah. Then there's this Finnish movie that I recently watched from Yle Areena, which maybe even more relates to this water porter system. It's in English, it's called Memory of Water. Mm-hmm. In Finnish, Veden Vartija. It's a Finnish science fiction movie. It's freely available in Yle Areena. I'm not sure about subtitles. But it's probably there is, but and I'm not sure if it's in Netflix or somewhere else. But anyway, the water is kind of a rare element all over the world at that movie. So then they are just the main character is kind of a water keeper who is. Making sure that people do get it.
Yeah, we are actually running out of time, but as you can hear, we could talk about this really long. So, shall I start? Thank you for listening us, and thank you, Ismail. It was really interesting and really loved.
Leon, thank you.
Merci.
Oh.
And thank you. Yeah, thank you for coming, and thank you for our listeners for listening to us. And remember that we have three other shows still coming. So Wednesday and Thursday it will be in Finnish, Tiede Nyt, and then Friday it will be again in English, Science Now. So we will talk about bending glass, aerosol particles, and polyhypes. So on Friday, we'll hear what exactly are polyhypes. But thank you, everyone, and see you again. Hear you again.
And you were produced by Sampo.
Thank you.
When we first came here, we were cold and we were clear. With no colors on our skin, we were light and paper thin. And when we first came here, we were cold and we were clear. With no colors on our skin, till we let the spectrum in. Say my name. Yeah.